one of the questions that we had from the first half, and I don't really have an answer for this, but I thought I'd throw it out to the group. You said we were thinking about the next generation. Actually, somebody was mentioning, you know, their kids. And I think this is a good topic for us to kind of ponder a little bit. You know, it's hard enough for us to discern, you know, how many cookies we should eat. I say eyeing my cookie over here. But we know that little kids, you know, like you give them a plate of cookies, they're going to want to eat them all. So, you know, they are more engrossed in the internet than we are, perhaps. You know, the younger generations are more engrossed than previous generations, let's put it that way. They don't have role models right above them that have lived through, you know, the amount of internet that they live through. I have a goddaughter who's 3 and a half. Boy, can she work her dad's iPad. She can download things. She's like, luckily, they will not tell her the password that she would have to spend money, because she doesn't actually know what money is. She just knows that, you know, this thing looks good, and if she puts these numbers in, she gets it. She'd be spending, I mean, and she'll download the same thing like 4 times, 5 times, 6 times. She has no sense because she's 3 and a half. Well, you know, I worry a little bit about this, although she also loves books. And, you know, even her older siblings, she has siblings who are teenagers, they didn't have this when they were growing up. So, you know, her parents are kind of in again, back to my map analogy, they're in uncharted territory. You know, is that, how much of that is okay? You know, like she's having fun with the games. You know, she doesn't seem to be maladjusted. You know, certainly a little bit of video games shouldn't be bad for her, but where do you draw the line? And what guidance do you have when you're dealing with kids?
Yeah, I was just going to say that I have 3 boys. One is 17, the oldest is 17, the youngest is 12. And the things that the 12-year-old is doing now, his 17-year-old brother wasn't doing, but because those COD or Call of Duty or whatever was not available. And right. If I say, well, this is too much time, you know, there's blood splashing. Oh, Mom, everybody's
doing it. Yes, yes. We don't know the consequences of everybody doing it yet. Yes, yes. Yeah, in the same family with my godchild, the boys, while I was visiting them at Christmas time, got a limit put on their video game playing because of something that they had done. And Mom and Dad were chuckling because they really didn't think that the boys knew what, you know, however many hours a week it was. Like, they didn't think they knew how much time they were spending in front of the video games, and they were betting that they would just blow through the whole week's worth of allowance on the first day. And then they're like, oh, we'll see what day 2 is like. Because, you know, the kids don't really realize what they're doing, how much time they're spending there. Yeah. So
there are a lot of dynamics in our lives.
They're complicated.
That lead us astray. So, you know, irrational beliefs like I must be perfect to be loved, or I must be I need to be needed, you know, all of these kind of things. That if we go to St. John Climacus, we have to go very deep into him before it dawns on us that these dynamics in our modern life never have been and will never get us what we need. Is there an Orthodox source that has addressed that, or will you write a book?
Oh, my first post-dissertation project. Well, you know, I typically look to what I call the monastic sources for that kind of thing. So Climacus or Maximus the Confessor's chapters on love. I know that there has been more contemporary writings about orthodoxy and psychology. I don't have titles off the top of my head, but I know that they're out there. I'm looking at John because I feel like you have assigned one of those in a class that I took with you. But anyway, but I'm not sure if that's, I would have to go back to those sources and look at them again to see if they're answering exactly the question that you're asking. It could be that it's out there, or it could be that I'll write it.
Your Theos Lakos has written some, being somewhat of a psychologist, but, you know, it's not in language that's easily comprehended or taken seriously by most of us.
Right. All right, well, I'll put it on my list of potential books. Potential books to write, yes.
May I ask you a very difficult question?
Oh, why not?
You have a very simple question, but a difficult one.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I'm afraid now.
How would you define ethics?
Oh,
and
yeah.
I warned you.
I've thought about this. I actually kick around a lot of different definitions of ethics, and I study ethics. Yeah, I study ethics with mostly at the GTU, the Graduate Theological Union. We do have an Orthodox Institute there, but most of my professors are Catholic or Protestant, and so I'm often a little bit dissatisfied with sort of the parameters of what I get in class. And I like to kind of mess with them a little bit. I like to say things like, I think of ethics as the form of repentance. You know, we repent, but we don't just say, oh, gosh, sorry, I didn't mean to do that. You know, there should be some effort to not sin, to go and sin no more. Going and sinning no more. This is somewhere in there is the foundation of ethics. Yes. Oh, The Therapy of Spiritual Illness from Alexander Press. Yes. It's from the internet. I can't read the little small writing, but oh, he has three volumes of this. Who is it by, John?
A Frenchman.
I can't find the author's name.
Yes. Larche.
Oh, Jean-Claude Larche. The Therapy of Spiritual Illness.
It's to be a Frenchman.
Yes, it was originally published in French, so if you would like to read it in French, you may. The title is even given, but I won't attempt to pronounce it.
There's also a Theology of Illness section by him.
All right, so there's a good resource. See, internet. Okay. The resources are on the internet.
How many people are going to read it?
Well, a few.
Well,
you can report back to us. So we are, we have basically wrapped up most of what I had, and I thought that I would leave some time for questions, and we have moved into, clearly we have kind of inched into some discussion time, but I thought I would also invite you to throw questions, not only to myself, but to John, if you want to tie things together, and maybe invite Mother Melania to also, if you wanted to throw some ideas. I know you weren't supposed to be on the docket today, but you're sitting here. So, I guess what I'm doing is inviting us to think about our day here and everything that we've heard today and what pressing questions or thoughts or what did we not say? Just sort of open the discussion up a little bit broader than discernment, although we can talk about discernment if we want to. Yes. Yes?
I always am interested about discernment because I know if we have discernment, we'll be top, we'll be like God. And God has asked us to be like Him and to be pure and to know what's right, what's wrong, and to do the right thing always. That's for me, is discernment. Mm-hmm. Like developing your sixth sense is part of it. Like to know what the future. Some people step in the future, being in the present, and they know what will happen, and it happened for them. So these are the very wise people, and I think I want to be like them.
Yes.
So that's what I feel about discernment. It's the top notch people who are really reaching heaven on earth, or already almost there, because they are like God. And God is in them. He's filling them.
I think that the good news there is, you don't start with discernment at that level. You start with discernment, at the low level and build up. So, discernment is something that you can tackle sort of no matter where you are. Build it up bit by bit, but, embrace it where you are. So it's not out of reach is what I'm saying. Just because it's the 26th step on the ladder doesn't mean that, we really don't have to think about it until we pass through all of the 25 steps before that. That's something we can start on and can start improving our lives, and we can start using it to really shape our souls now.
So you have to be spiritual, and you have to have faith, and you have to read the Bible, and you have to love people, you have to be pure. Mm-hmm. And you have to be lots of things in order to get to that point.
Don't forget to go to liturgy.
Yes, that's one thing I have to do, because I'm really not going, I'm up there north in the Fort Bragg area, and I don't have the church around me that I'm used to go. But I have to get into a church, Catholic church, I would say.
And yeah. That's somebody has mentioned just a few minutes ago that you can, when you can't go out, you can, you know, when you're snowed in, you can watch online. Yeah. So, I mean, it's better than nothing. You know, ideally you would be, what's that?
Reader
services that you can pray at home. There's lots of options that you could be doing. I mean, I think ideally you would be in a parish, in a community, you know, regularly, so you have that interaction with the community. We have community out here, yes. You know, that's an important piece of the puzzle, but obviously we don't all live in ideal situations. I mean, I think about this often as I finish my PhD, and the job market's tough, so I'll take a job where I can find a job, but I just sort of hope I don't end up, we joke about ending up in a place that we call Our Lady of Perpetual Cornfield, which would mean that it's in the middle of campus or, you know, whatever. You know, like, what if I'm 3 hours from an Orthodox church? You know, it's within the realm of possibility, and you know we have to cope as best we can.
Start
one. Yes, there you go.
Evangelical mission.
Thank you.
As I said earlier, that the internet in the end is about technology itself, and this technology in the end, I believe, confuses us, especially our sense and numbs it, what is reality and what is fantasy. What happens is, as we're exposed to this technology, we're not really sure in the end that the real life itself outside technology is the life we want to live. But we'd rather be inside our room and control that reality, because it's easier to be lord of that life, if I can say. And to me, I think the best summary of this, I was sharing this earlier with another individual, that the internet is sort of like the cave in Plato's allegory of the cave. Mm-hmm. Is that in there, a person is born into a reality of shadows, not real, because all that person sees are the shadows of animals passing by and thinking, oh, that is a chicken coming by, because I could hear it and I could see it. And then one day you leave that cave and you go to the light where you can see the true image of it, and it's not something that you want. You'd rather go back to the darkness that you've gotten used to. And I sort of believe that the internet is kind of like that in time, is you begin to get numb as to... It really numbs your senses in the end. Somebody spoke about that. It does that very so easily. I would finally add that how real is this, is that it's coming to a point now where animation is getting so real that you could actually animate an old movie star. It's going to come to that. And say John Wayne, who's been dead for years and years, decades, and he will come to a point where you can make a film about him, and the analog, the programming, to copy all of his words and movements. You cannot tell the difference between an old John Wayne film and a new John Wayne film, and just say, oh my gosh, that's him, he's come back to life. And so that's where it's going, and I've seen it, and that's where technology is now, is that what is real, what is fantasy, it's going to get harder and harder to differentiate.
What I would say about that is that those of us in the church have a good line on what is real. You know, we know, and we have to share that. You know, and this is our, you know, back to being an ethicist. You know, you have a moral responsibility to share that with those that are in the cave and thinking that reality is real. You know, and that might be each other in the church to reinforce what we know is real. That might be to, you know, children, godchildren, those outside the church, neighbors, whoever it may be, you know, to give them a hint of where the light is and where that reality is. And hopefully, you know, God will work through that. But what you're describing, though, with the cave, I think it's a real serious spiritual illness. Getting back to our spiritual illness, it's a reality for us today. You know, it takes a form that's different today. But obviously, if Plato was describing it, lo, those many years ago, it's something that's been around. And you know, we've tackled it before. We'll tackle it again. Sorry.
Mother Mahania, on occasion, just mentions about what's real or not. I wondered if you wouldn't mind just elaborating a little bit. I could hear it again.
I could hear it for the first time.
You're on occasion speak about what is the real life and what isn't. I've heard you allude to this a couple times. I'm just wondering if you wouldn't mind sharing with all of us. I'd like to hear it again.
Well, I don't know. I'm still trying to figure out. I'm not exactly sure which part of what I might have been talking about that you had in mind, but what is real is to love the Lord our God with all our heart and mind and soul and strength and our neighbors ourselves, and everything else is illusory. So, but we're not there. So what do we need to do? I mean, we need to do the thing in front of us. It's like, if I don't love God very much, and I don't love my brother very much, but if I did, what would I do? And you know what? I'll probably be wrong some of the time because I'm still blinded. But if I am at least honestly trying to ask that question and honestly praying to God, then little by little, I will see reality because all those layers of mud are going to come off bit by bit. So I don't know if I answered your question enough, Paul.
Very nice.
I